Welcome to Learning for Life. I'm your host, Sarah Shane. In today's episode, I talk with two instructors, Elaine Trott and Ashley King. Elaine will share with us some interesting stories about the founding of New York City and talk about her love for her hometown. Next, Ashley King will enlighten us about the current state of the collectibles market. Let the seller beware. First up, Elaine and the history of New York City. Hi, Elaine. Welcome to Learning for Life.
Hi. Thank you for having me. This is exciting. I'm honored.
You're our inaugural interviewee for this podcast. And the reason I'm interviewing you is so many people have enjoyed your course titled The History of New York. But I have an interesting question I want to start with. Tell me your favorite food that you associate with New York City.
Oh, that's easy. Pizza, a slice of pizza. You just can't get a slice of pizza anywhere else that tastes as good as the New York pizza.
Conventional wisdom is that cities like New York are dangerous places, but how do you feel?
No, I'm pretty confident going to New York City. I walk like a New Yorker, like I know what I'm doing, and I cross the street like a New Yorker, like you don't really have to look at the lights, and I always wear the New Yorker outfit, which is white, black, with an ankle bracelet.
White and black, that seems to be the chic outfit, correct?
Absolutely. Look at any New Yorker's wardrobe. You'll see plenty of black. Other people, if you don't feel like wearing black, that's fine. They accept anything. But the New York typical wardrobe is black, white, and for women, an ankle bracelet.
Elaine, tell me something about New York that most people don't know.
Okay. Well, it started a lot of things. It's accomplished more than Paris and London have. And it's only 400 years old. Paris and London are 1,500 years old. Rome is 2,000, Beijing 3,000, and Jerusalem 4,000. And yet New York has tested immigration, it's tested industrialization, it's expanded the urban scene, it has a multicultural working society, and many other things.
Who founded New York?
It was founded by Henry Hudson. He made three explorations to the New World. The first one, he landed in Canada. He's English, and the English had hired him for that particular expedition. Then he was hired by the Dutch for the second expedition, and that's when he saw the harbor. He said, this harbor has possibilities. But even he couldn't have imagined what was going to happen. Then he went back, and he was hired again for the English. And he came, and he was on the Hudson River, and there was this awful, awful winter storm, and the men were there for 3 months, the whole winter, and they were fed up. So when spring came, they said, we want to go back to England. And he said, no, we're here to explore. And after a while, they decided to mutiny him. So they put him in a wooden rowboat with his son and a few other men who were loyal to him. And they went back to England. And he was never heard of again. Nobody knows what happened to Henry Hudson. That was the end of him.
Wow. That's a fascinating story. I bet most people don't know that.
Most people don't know that, that's for sure.
So is there laughter, shock, surprise? How do people respond to that in your class when you tell them that story?
Shock. They can't believe it. You mean nobody ever found anything? So I explained to them that when JFK Jr. went down in a plane into the water, I said to my cousin, oh, I wonder if they'll find him. And my cousin said, with today's technology, they will find him. And, of course, they did. But back in 1609, they didn't have any of that technology. And anything could have happened to him. Indians could have gotten him. The rowboat could have disintegrated, whatever.
In your course, you cover the immigrant experience, correct? And especially, it's very topical, and in the news today, we have a lot of discussion of the modern immigrant experience, perhaps sometimes with a little bit of amnesia about the immigrant experience of the past. When you teach your course, what groups do you focus on in terms of immigration from the earliest founding of the city?
Well, the Germans came, and they had some problems, but the big problems came with the Irish, because they were not Protestant. They were the first Catholic group to come over, and they were heavily resented. And it was quite interesting to find the details of their lives and how they revolted and how they let their frustrations known, and how eventually they became integrated, and they gave us great institutions like Notre Dame and so forth. The Italians came next, and they also were Italian, and they were Catholic, and they also met a lot of discrimination, and they had problems, but not quite as awful as the Irish. New York City is a true melting pot, and I wish people would study the history of New York City and see how they eventually integrated the various immigrants. And even today, they are doing a better job than most places in the United States. They are a true sanctuary city.
Can I ask you about your ethnic background?
Yeah, I was my four grandparents came over here from Eastern Europe as Jews. And my parents were both born in New York City, and we are very proud of the Jewish contributions to New York City. We also had a lot of prejudice initially. In fact, Peter Stuyvesant, the general of New Amsterdam, didn't want to allow the first Jews into New York City, but the West India Company said to him, "We are a business. We are not a religious colony, and if they will help us and work and not make trouble, they are welcome." And he was stunned, but he had to let them in.
So from the earliest founding of our country, there was a little bit of a no Jews allowed prejudice, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah, just like other groups. Peter Stuyvesant was very skeptical about certain Protestant groups that came over. But he had to let them in because it was a working business community. It wasn't a religious community, as opposed to the Pilgrims and the Puritans. It was one of the few colonies that was set up for business.
Elaine, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I lived in New York City. I was raised in New York City. And I moved to New Jersey. I was a special education teacher. Then I retired and started taking classes at CLR. And finally, when I decided to teach at CLR, I felt as though I was teaching special ed gifted, because the people were so so wonderful and so involved and gave me such encouragement. And I've been teaching for a year now. This fall will be the beginning of the second year.
Do you have any advice or suggestions to anyone who is a CLR member who may be thinking of teaching a course?
Sure. It's very easy. First of all, you have to love what you're teaching. That's mm-hmm. the primary thing. And the second thing is, know that you will get a lot of help from the CLR faculty. You will spend a lot of time preparing for your classes, but you have a lot of opportunity in the library. The Bucks County Library has tons of books and information. And I use a lot of YouTube information and other information on the internet to fill in and make it exciting.
That was Elaine Trott, instructor at CLR. Thanks, Elaine, for joining us today on Learning for Life.
Here at Christie's at 350 million and looking for another bid, please, Francois, at 350. Loic and Francois, it is with Alex Rotter at 400 million. Leonardo Salvatore Mundi selling here at Christie's. $400 million is the bid, and the piece is sold.
I'm here with Ashley King, who teaches the class What Are Your Treasures Worth at CLR. Well, that was an exciting bit of audio. I think what most people think of when you say auction, and that's the kind of picture that comes to mind.
Wow. Can you imagine the heart that was beating of that auctioneer as those bids were increased.
That's not really what a local auction is like, or is it?
It could be. Mm-hmm. I have seen things go for millions of dollars.
Really?
At local auctions. Local to Philadelphia, more or less Philadelphia auctions. But it could very well be.
Are there pros and cons of using auction houses versus selling something a different way?
Well, from my experience and what I do recommend is it depends on what it is. If you're selling things that are household items, no, sell them at auction and take what you get. But if you do have, for instance, I was at an auction last week and there was a cast iron model of a steam engine. And I'm sitting there and I thought it might bring a couple of $1,000s. That cast iron model engine went for $18,000.
How much?
At a little local auction. $18,000.
If people don't want, now that's a wonderful example, but if people have those small household items, what are some other places they could sell their treasures?
Well, there are many local auctions that you're going to see that advertise and do sell on a weekly basis. There's an auction in Buckingham, Pennsylvania that sells weekly. So naturally he's looking for and he will sell whatever he can get. There are other people who sell biweekly. There are other auctioneers who sell monthly. So depending on what you have, you have to make a decision as to where you want to take it.
I was asking whether there are pros. Obviously, you can try to, I guess, up the value if you're in an auction setting. But what are the cons of going with an auction rather than just bringing somebody in and just having somebody give you a price for something?
Well, the biggest con is that you're going to have to accept because these auctions sell without reserve. So, for instance, if you're sitting there and nobody's interested in what's being offered, and that item happens to be yours, then it's going to go for pennies or not at all.
Do you have the ability to withdraw it from the auction, or once you're in, you're in?
No. Once you're in, you're in. It's going to be sold without reserve.
Okay. So a lot of people might think that they've got that $400 million Salvador Mundi, but maybe they only have, you know, grandma's teacup.
A lot of people wish they had that Mundi.
That's true. I would imagine folks could get ripped off if they really didn't know what their object is worth. How important is it to get an independent appraisal? And how do appraisers work?
Well, it's very important. I'm actually a certified appraiser of clocks and watches, and I get called in all the time.
Now, you're honest.
Well, I hope so.
Right.
Yes.
How can our listeners be on the lookout for, how would they identify a dishonest appraiser?
A certified appraiser, ethically, cannot purchase whatever you're looking at. So if you're looking at somebody's item, you're out of the picture to purchase that item. You're giving this person an honest opinion. There are appraisers that advertise that set up in hotel rooms, and you go in there, and yes, they're going to appraise it, but they're giving you a number as to what they're willing to pay. That's really not honest.
So I think that one of the benefits of your class is you really gave people an education in this whole area. I took your class last semester. It was fun. And I learned a lot. And we had a lot of retirees, folks over 50, who are thinking of downsizing. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to know what they had in their homes. Was it a valuable? And I think some people were surprised at some of the answers you gave them. Some people thought that they had, you know, treasures in their collection of, what do you call those plates? The plates, a lot of fun.
The blue plates,
you know. And then it turned out, although it's very lovely and they enjoy it, but it doesn't have the value that they thought.
That's right.
Because people thought that they would...
Well, it's like Hummels. I mean, people have accumulated Hummels over the years, and the interest in Hummels has come way down. So consequently, that doesn't mean they don't have any value. They just don't have anywhere near the value that individuals were hoping that they...
And what about the antique furniture, that beautiful hutch somebody might have that's with the dark brown wood?
Well, unfortunately, brown wood is not in vogue anymore. And that's a big question that a lot of people ask. And it always comes up as to why millennials are not, or children, are not keeping this furniture or looking to hold on to it. There are reasons, there are answers. That's a long discussion as to why, but it is going on.
I remember we had that discussion.
That's right. Furniture is down. Brown furniture is way down.
In your class, you hold a mini antiques roadshow where people can learn about what their treasures are worth in a fun and entertaining way. We're going to listen to a short excerpt from that class. Can you set the scene for us?
Sarah, it is always fun to ask individuals, especially in this class, to bring in whatever they have, and they're there. I mean, if you remember, when I opened up the class, I asked everyone to introduce themselves and tell me why you're here. Everybody has something, especially in this age group. They all have something. So it is so much fun to watch these individuals, what they have, and for them to bring them in, and in a roadshow format, to explain to them what their particular item, their collectible item, is worth. It's enjoyable.
To go home crying today, all right? The values are the values. We don't come up with the values. It's just what they are. And if anyone goes home crying, I feel bad. This is an ironstone cup and saucer from the 19th century. Back in the 19th century, they didn't have little finger rings. You picked up your cup like this. Used for whatever you wanted it for. Tea, coffee, what have you. I would say the 1850 to about 1875 is when a lot of this stuff was made. The values have gone down a bit. And for a cup and saucer with no chips that I can see, it's just, you know, it's gotten darker over the years. You're probably looking at about $65 to $75 on this.
So that's a long way away from a $444 million Rembrandt. But that's probably the average find that you come across, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And as I recall, this cup and saucer belonged to this lady's great's grandmother. And that just because it's old, and definitely that would make it old, doesn't really make it worth a tremendous amount of money. That has to be understood, and that's usually the case.
Now, you did surprise our class with a story about a very simple, everyday item. Can you tell me about that?
The story is that a friend of mine who grew up here in the Philadelphia area was asked by his mother, who was born in Austria and an antique dealer, was asked to go out and dig up around old buildings, dig through the ground, and look for buttons. So he remembers spending his early years, his high school or earlier than high school years, digging up buttons. And he did this over a period of quite a few years. And the button collection accumulated into about three shoebox fulls of buttons. And she passed away, of course, and time marched on. He needed to market that particular button collection. He took the collection to an auction house up in New Hampshire. Don't recall the name of it. But I did see the check. When he got in the mail the check for the button collection, I saw a check made out for $96,000.
Whoa, $96,000
for buttons? That's right, for three shoe boxes full of buttons.
What was so special about the buttons?
Well, they were, here we are in the Philadelphia area, so I'm sure that the majority of the buttons were, or a lot of them, certainly enough, were Revolutionary War, earlier perhaps. A lot of them were carved out of bone. A lot of them, there were some brass military, I went through, looked at them a little bit, military buttons from uniforms. But they were all early. And button collecting seems to be a popular thing, even still in this country. And to whoever paid $96,000 for those buttons, plus the commission to the auctioneer, really wanted those buttons.
So if people are interested in learning more, they should sign up for your class by going to the CLR website.
Right.
Ashley, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for listening to Learning for Life. I'm Sarah Shane. I wrote and produced this podcast, editing and original music by Larry Lefkowitz. Let us know what you think by going to the Delaware Valley University CLR website. Click on Request Information. We look forward to hearing from you. The opinions expressed in Learning for Life do not reflect those of Delaware Valley University CLR.